Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I had a show prepared, and then I had to jettison the first part of it because of the news that came out Wednesday that we have had our first fatality in the United States from measles. There's an epidemic in Texas, as you've probably heard, 124 cases, and 9 cases in New Mexico. 80% are children. What's really sad about this child is that this was a healthy, normal child. This wasn't a sick child. This wasn't a baby. This was a grade school child who could have lived a long and happy life. The child came into the hospital earlier this month. They had a high fever. They were having difficulty breathing without assistance. That is the sign of either a viral or a secondary bacterial pneumonia. By the way, just parenthetically, what kills most people from influenza is not the influenza. It's the secondary pneumonia. It's like you know, kicking the lungs while they're down, and that is very difficult to come back from. These are not the usual pneumonia bugs. Anyway, this child spent some time in the ICU and on a ventilator and eventually failed and developed heart problems. There have been so far about 9 measles deaths during the current outbreak. Most of the doctors down there in Lubbock, Texas, who are taking care of these people have never seen a case of measles. That particular hospital where the child dies has treated about 20 patients. They've all been children. They've all been unvaccinated. Now, most children recover from measles. Some die of pneumonia, and some die of that secondary infection I talked about. Some get encephalitis and suffer from brain damage. And the vaccination rates in this county, Gaines County, are below average. So, of course, there was a big meeting today, and actually, I guess it was yesterday, Wednesday, that the cabinet met for the first time, and our new Secretary of Health and Human Services stood up and immediately spouted out a number of factual errors in a sort of off-the-cuff comment. He said he thought there were about 124 people who'd gotten the disease. He said there's 2 people who've died. Actually, the health department says no, there's only one person who's died, and 20 people are hospitalized, but most of that's for quarantine. Actually, people are never quarantined in hospitals. They're quarantined at home if they're not critically ill, because measles is so incredibly contagious. It is the most contagious virus. It is easily 10 times more contagious than COVID. Other little factual outbreaks is the efforts that Kennedy made to minimize this, saying, oh, we have measles outbreaks every year. A measles outbreak, by the way, that's probably true. It's defined as 3 or more related cases. But the tally in Texas for the first 2 months of 2025 has actually passed the annual case count for 2020, 2021, 2022, and 2023. Last year, we had a jump, and we had 285 measles cases. Well, so far, we have, in the first 2 months of 2025, 124. That's a very, very high death rate. That's 1 out of 124 reported cases. There are probably more cases, but since all of our data is case counts from official testing, we can pretty much assume that the same number of people are being tested. Now, this could just be a statistical fluke. The typical death rate is 1 per 1,000. typically, during a measles outbreak, about 1 in 5 people who get sick will need hospital care, and about 1 in 20 will get pneumonia. And rarely, measles can lead to encephalitis, which causes swelling of the brain, can cause death, it can cause premature birth, low birth weight, and as I mentioned earlier, encephalitis and permanent brain damage. Lest you forget, our new Secretary of Health and Human Services, who has named a prominent vaccine skeptic as the lead of the CDC, that's going to turn out well. He got into a little bit of trouble back in 2019 when he went to Samoa and he met with activists. You know, he's a anti-vaccine influencer back in 2019. And he called for Samoans to skip measles vaccine. About 5 months later, there was a major measles outbreak that infected thousands and 83 people died. So this is a non-trivial disease. And it's particularly dangerous, just like COVID, for people who are poorer, very young, or very old. Fortunately, most of the very old people had measles, a single case of which confers lifelong immunity. My mother had measles, and she had encephalitis, and it damaged her vision, which was something she got to live with for the rest of her life. But recent data has turned up something that's really frightening, and this was research released this week at ID Week, which is the annual meeting of 4 different professional infectious disease associations, if you will, or organizations. And this is so I'm going to tell you about a late complication of measles that can occur years after an attack of measles. And you can have not gotten that sick from this attack. It has to be young children, unvaccinated, and the condition is called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. So essentially it's a little bit like shingles, except shingles is reactivating from the spinal cord and typically goes to the skin of the trunk and hurts. This one reactivates in the brain and kills you. We have no treatment for it, and it is 100% fatal. So how frequent is it? Well, the new findings that came out from the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and the California Department of Public Health found that for babies who get measles before being vaccinated, the rate is 1 in 600 who can expect to develop this SSPE condition. And that's starting to get uncomfortably high. In 2015, you may remember there was a measles epidemic, an outbreak at Disneyland that made Orange County the center of the worst measles outbreak that California had in 15 years. 24 cases in that epidemic involved children under age 2 who are now at risk of developing the always fatal SSPE, and we can't do anything about it. In the study, the researchers analyzed cases of California children who got measles between 1998 and 2015, and they found 1 in 1,300 were younger than 5 when infected. They identified 17 cases of SSPE, all of whom in people who had measles before being vaccinated. All but one of those patients died. A 5-year-old boy who was infected during travel to Germany is still alive. He's in hospice. He's unable to move or respond to commands. So you can say he's still alive, but that's not a child who's going to have a life. The range from infection to SSPE identification can be as much as 35 years. And many of the patients had ongoing cognitive or movement problems before they were diagnosed. It typically progresses in stages, often starting with subtle signs and behavioral problems. Eventually, the person develops seizures and develops brain damage and becomes comatose. Another little detail about this is, for reasons that no one understands, Asians are disproportionately affected by SSPE. So what's measles? It's fever, red eyes, sore throat, runny nose, and then 2 or 3 days in, you get a very widespread and not particularly interesting looking rash, you know, little red dots. But that's measles. Another thing we see in measles is white spots on the inside of the cheeks. Those are called coplic spots. So we've all been trained to identify measles in the wild, but most of us, and I would include myself in that number, have never actually seen a typical case of childhood measles, just because it has been so rare. No longer, I'm afraid, and that, well, that's A, it's crying shame, and B, somebodies should be ashamed of being indirectly responsible for frightening patients and frightening parents that they might be hurting their child when a vaccine, when in fact not vaccinating your child stands a much greater chance of hurting them. This is sort of coming through from the health departments of Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Cruz County, and also the California Department of Public Health. It's a community survey. I want to encourage everyone to take the survey. It's regarding the energy storage facility fire in Monterey County that started on January 16th, foreboding and inauspicious moment for our local community. And so the link is available on the KSQD website. I'll let you know what it is as well. But you can go to ksqd.org/MLBFHS. And that'll take you to the survey. I'm going to open in a new tab right now and take a look. I understand that the survey is wanting to ask questions about whether you're having any symptoms. There it is in English. And it's voluntary, it's private. And the idea here is you're going to pick your zone where you live, and they're going to gather debris. So wanting to know if you had smoke or dust or anything or odor or anything that you were aware of, and whether you developed any symptoms since that fire. And there's a whole list of symptoms, you know, sort of things that you might expect, like chest tightness or sore throat, but also things you might not necessarily think about, like a rash or muscle spasms, vomiting. We're trying to gather as much information as we can. There's been various findings. I'm sure you've heard on the news that the core samples of the Earth did not show substantial metals and amounts of copper and nickel. However, surface testing did. I think that's quite understandable. The core samples were taken before the latest rains. It would be interesting if they were repeated in the same locations, because I suspect that, you know, when you take a core sample, you're basically making a cylinder, right? And then the dirt that is below is going to essentially dilute out the materials that are on the surface. And so you may not really have the same results after things have been allowed to soak in. Realistically, I'm not so worried about copper and nickel. Those were the surface things that were found. If you think you might have been exposed, nickel I don't consider to be particularly toxic. And as far as copper is concerned, it's actually an important nutrient. And the best way to deal with getting too much copper is to start taking zinc, because zinc helps balance copper. So You know, I think that I encourage you to do the survey as a good citizen, and I think that's what this act, what this is. It's the act of a good citizen to help us figure things out. And so your chance to stand up and take a moment and offer some citizenship energy, I strongly encourage it. So our first email from the night comes from Karen in Philadelphia. The subject, mushroom coffee. Hi, Dr. Don. I look forward every week to hearing your podcasts and always learn a great deal. I wanted to hear your thoughts on adaptogens. I've had many issues with gastritis and possibly irritable bowel syndrome and read comments about the benefits of mushroom coffee and bloating, so I thought I'd give it a try. I have been drinking a mushroom coffee with 6 different mushrooms, including lion's mane, once a day for about the 6 months. I crave it every day, but I wonder if it's due to the small amount of instant coffee in it. I do feel it has possibly helped with stomach bloating, although I am currently going through a flare-up and it isn't doing much for that. Just wanted to get your opinion and professional knowledge on the benefits of mushrooms for the body. Well, mushrooms are fabulous. I liked people to eat mushrooms. They contain compounds that are anti-cancer and compounds that stimulate immunity in a positive way, particularly those anti-cancer, antiviral fighting T cells. They like their mushrooms. Our research has shown us that and most of this research, I should say, comes out of Japan, and so it's not widely known amongst American oncologists, but it shows fairly potent effects of mushrooms for being adjuvant agents in chemotherapy and improving outcomes. So I'm very much encouraging that. Other research, however, shows that people tend to become what the term of medical art is tachyphylactic. And what it really means is that we become unreactive to mushrooms over time if we take them all the time. So my recommendation is that you rotate your mushroom coffee. So rather than using a single product with all of the mushrooms, maybe get one that has, or make one, you know, coffee grinder and dried mushrooms and some instant coffee and you're there. So it's really easy to make. But I would switch the mushrooms around and maybe do, lion's mane and shiitake for a month and then switch to maiake and, you know, just keep it moving so that the body doesn't adapt out to its response. Eventually, if you are hearing a ticking clock, your brain will turn off the sound. You won't hear it anymore. You adapt to it. That sort of adaptation also happens at the level of the immune system. That's kind of how allergy desensitization therapy works when you stop and think about it. So much for mushrooms. I think they're great. I would definitely not take the same ones for long periods of time. I think you'll blunt your benefit. Let's see if that caller's still here on line one. Hello?
Oh, hi. I have a quick question.
Can you tell us your name and where you're calling from first?
Carolina from Santa Cruz.
Hi, Carolina.
And I had German measles that I didn't. How is that different from the regular measles, and does it give you immunity for the regular measles?
It is a completely different virus. So, so it's called rubella, and measles is rubeola, and they are similar in that they cause fever and that they cause a rash. The rashes are distinct, and you don't get the coplic spots. But, you know, from the standpoint of the person with the illness, measles is much worse and more dangerous. Rubella is only a problem if you happen to be a pregnant woman who's unvaccinated, in which case it's a hideous infection, and it can cause severe damage, birth defects, and fetal death. So we like to immunize our people before they get pregnant. If you can go get a serology test at the lab, and they will tell you whether you have antibodies to measles, mumps, and rubella. That's a very commonly done test when people don't know their vaccination history or their infection history. Not an expensive test to do. But that's the difference between the two.
So then the German measles won't give immunity against rubella because it's
It's different virus.
Completely different.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you. I will try to go get that test.
Yeah, get yourself checked out for your disease titer, because you should. It's really easy and it could make a huge difference.
Okay. Yeah, and is there a shot that you can get that prevents... Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, so we can prevent all of those, including German measles. The measles vaccine is really measles, mumps, and German measles. So we routinely vaccinate against it, or we were routinely vaccinating against it. We're starting to see... you get below about 90% of the population, and we're getting close there. Some areas are less than 90%. This, for every person who gets measles, it can be up to 14 other people. Like if you're in a classroom and one kid comes to school with measles, likely half the classroom is going to get measles if they were all unvaccinated. We know this from before we had a vaccine back in the 30s and 40s. There were no measles vaccine. That thing that came out in the I think in the early 60s, we finally got a measles vaccine. Prior to that, we would lose, you know, a few babies every year. It was just like, oh, you've got really severe, and mostly it was a childhood disease that kept you home for a couple of weeks. And that's when you're in grade school, it's hardly to be despised to have to stay home.
I'm 78, and is the vaccine safe for me?
Absolutely. But it's very likely that you had it as a child and had a low-grade case and just it didn't register with anybody. So get the titers before you get the vaccine.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the question. Keep listening.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so let's go to some... nature sourcing. You've heard of crowdsourcing, I'm sure. Well, we've got some articles here about nature sourcing new therapeutic tools. Now, have you heard of a tardigrade or a water bear? And if you have not, and you have a smartphone with you, I want you to look this one up. T-A-R-D-I-G-R-A-D-E-S. Tardigrades. They are my hands down favorite animal. As a person who went through medical training and internship and medical residency, I have to tell you, we are talking 3-year boot camp, trial by fire, and I admire resilience. This tiny organism can withstand huge amounts of radiation. It can be dried out, desiccated, and it's so small. It's like a millimeter across. You can barely even see it. And they like to grow they like to wander around in moss. Sometimes they're called moss piglets. They're also called water bears. They are so cute. And if you can find some films online, and you will if you look, they move like pandas. They're just cute little toddly critters. And the amazing thing about them, as I said, they can handle desiccation, they can dry out, they can handle vacuum. But if you desiccate them completely, and they have done this, you can find like dead tardigrades in an old trunk or something. They look dead, but if you rehydrate them, they come back and they can actually breed, which is just crazy. So they aren't even damaged. They're capable of a suspended animation. So some scientists, working on treating cancer, were kicking things around, looking at new ways to protect people from radiation. And they said, the tardigrades have this protein that protects them from radiation. I wonder if we could, kind of nature source that protein, figure out a way to get it into people so that they could be protected against radiation. So what the researchers did was they went and found the DNA for the protein that the tardigrades make that protects them against radiation, and they injected it into mice. And it generated enough protein to protect the cells of the mice from radiation-induced damage. Now, of course, this has wonderful potential for protecting cancer patients, but also space exploration comes to mind immediately, because once we get outside of that lovely magnetic field that surrounds us like a soft baby blanket, we are in trouble when it comes to being damaged by radiation. Radiation is often used to treat cancers of the head and neck. It can damage the mouth or throat, causing severe inflammation, like a giant case of oral and throat herpes, making it painful to eat or drink. It's also used for gastrointestinal cancers, and it can lead to rectal bleeding. So many people can't take their treatments. Squamous cell carcinoma of the mouth is a very common cancer. It's caused by the human papillomavirus and combination with tobacco, and the compounds, in particularly chewing tobacco, have really raised the rates of this in American men in the last generation or so. But these mouth sores can really limit a person's ability to eat and even require hospitalization, because people have to have IV food, IV fluids, and narcotics to take with the pain. And this has been a real problem. So what's up here? This key component of the tardigrade's defense system is a damage suppressor protein called DSUP. It binds to DNA and helps protect it from radiation-induced damage. The tardigrades are able to survive radiation doses, get this, 3,000 times higher than what a human being can tolerate. So what they discovered was they were able to deliver this messenger RNA encoding DSUP into the mice, and it would temporarily trigger cells to express the protein. And so temporarily the protein would be present in the tissue. After a few hours, the RNA would disappear, the protein would disappear. So they looked at how could they deliver it. They looked at delivery particles that could be used to get it to penetrate tissue. They found one polymer lipid particle that worked for the colon and another that worked for the mouth. And they're working on showing that this can be helpful in humans. They've shown that they could deliver it in the lab. Now they're injecting these particles with this carrier compound into the cheek or the rectum, and then give the mice a dose of radiation similar to what cancer patients would receive. And they saw a 50% reduction in the amount of double-stranded DNA breaks. And what was cool is that the protein did not spread beyond the injection site. So similar to the COVID vaccine, it stayed where it was. It got produced locally. The compound, in the case of COVID, the spike protein, here it's the DSUP protein. But it was produced by the mouse's own cells. It didn't hang around that long, but it hung around, in the case of the vaccine, long enough to provoke an immune reaction. In the case of this, long enough to protect the mice. So now we need to do further research, of course, because it's before it's ready for prime time. But particularly, we need to make sure that it won't cause an antigenic or an immune response, which is one of the problems that we always encounter when we use an animal protein, because that's a foreign invader protein as far as the immune system is concerned. So a little work yet to be done, but a really amazing nature-sourced, game-changing agent. And I can't help it. I just love that it comes from tardigrades. All right. We have a caller online. Hello. And tell me your name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, it's Bill in Santa Cruz.
Hello, Bill. What can I do for you tonight?
Well, I have a big one and a little one. I'll do the big one first. Most people who heat their homes do it with wood or usually electric system, or most of all, gas, natural gas. And I'm assuming that the natural gas, the particles, are not exactly enhancing the health of the lungs or the arterioles and anything else, but I'm just assuming that. Now, I'm not doing this because of the assumptions we all made about the fires down in Moss Landing, lithium ion storage facility.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about natural gas being burned and piped into homes.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about what, as it happens, I had an article. We were going to talk about this in a different context, but I have some data right here. And this is for gas stoves, and it also has data for natural gas engines. And I'm guessing that, you know, gas heaters might be very similar to gas stoves in terms of the amount of energy that's being burned. I'm not really sure. If anything, gas heaters might burn more energy than cooking your dinner in a gas stove. But the amount of particles that are produced, and these are nanoparticles that get into the atmosphere, are fairly significant. About 10 million nanoparticles per cubic centimeter, and that's per minute. So that's a lot of little particles, and these are the small particles that can get all the way down into the your lungs at and get across the lungs and actually get into the bloodstream, and from there, of course, they can go anywhere, including the brain. And we talked last week about microplastics and nanoplastics. So this is pollution. This is a form of indoor air pollution, and these small particles can we know that they can cause damage. Presumably, there are substantial health issues. On the other hand, freezing to death has substantial health issues. So you kind of have a lot of concessions. But yes, it is likely that there is some indoor air pollution related to the use of gas stoves and gas heaters.
All right. Well, that's what I was guessing, just because I assume it's sort of like, as you say, nanoparticles, and, you know, we're changing the world so fast, our bodies, it's going to take generations before they adjust, and it won't be in a good direction. The other question is tiny, but radishes, besides vitamin C, what do radishes do for the diet or for the health? And I'll hang up right now.
Okay, before you go, I wanted to just say that if you look in the context of human existence, the environment has always been dirty in one way or another. I mean, back when we were living in caves, we had to deal with mold spores and, lots of bacteria and lots of contaminated dust. So our bodies are really good at handling old-fashioned molecules, the sort of things that we might have encountered through evolution. It's the newer molecules, and of course, one would look at natural gas as being something that had essentially no presence except at maybe volcanic vents until relatively recently. So that's, I'm hoping that for many of these carbon-based compounds that don't have weird, like, double bonds or things like fluorine in them, that our bodies will adapt fairly quickly to finding ways to deal with them. And the problem is wear and tear, right? It's aging us. It's aging our lungs. It's aging our tissues. So good ventilation if you're going to use those, if you have to heat that way. I want to put in a pitch for heat pumps, which are very efficient way to heat a home. And I'm fortunate in that I could afford one. I know that we just installed it, and it's really been, we were heating with wood fire with a catalytic converter on it. But nevertheless, I know that wasn't a very good thing to be doing, but it's what would work for the house. So I'm urging everybody who can to look into that. And I expect, I would have expected there to be government subsidies to help people make the switch, but all bets are off on that. So, have a great day. The radishes provide a lot of fiber, and they provide some other nutrients. I'd have to look it up to tell you exactly what's in there. But the main thing that I love about radishes is that your microbiome likes radishes. So you'll be growing healthy bugs that will help reduce inflammation in your body all over. And that is a good thing as we age.
Okay.
All right. Bye for now.
All right, bye.
So we've been talking about crowdsourcing from our nature sourcing. Here's another example of learning from nature. And you probably have been in a situation where you were working with pipes and plumbing and trying to glue something that was wet, or trying to glue something that was wet outside in the rain. Yeah, it's hard to get things to glue when they're wet. And that's because the water forms a barrier. You know, water has that high surface tension. It likes to spread out on surfaces. And so it gets between the surface and the molecules in the adhesive that are trying to bond to the surface. But there's one animal that has no trouble with this, aggressively able to attach itself to rocks and ship hulls, and that's mussels. Yep, we're a coastal community, so we are all familiar with those mussels, and they're very, very stuck on. Scientists have been inspired by mussels to create new adhesive that work in wet environments. Here's a wet environment we're all interested in, inside the human body. So some of these adhesives are being used to make surgical glues. They can stop bleeding. They can hold skin grafts together. They can bond implants to bones and keep stem cells in place long enough to repair tissue damage. But researchers at MIT and Free University Berlin have now found a way to make muscle-inspired adhesives even better with the help of a bodily substance, mucus. Mucus is that natural gooey stuff. It lubricates the inner surfaces of the body and the nose, the gut, protects it from infection. And this could help for many of the biomedical applications of the adhesives we're talking about. So, talking about the muscle glue, to strengthen this glue, muscles use two different chemical compounds, one called catechol and the other called thiols. Thiols are sulfur and hydrogen bonds, and they cross-link and like the hoops and loops on Velcro. So there's thiols in them that are mucus proteins. They're called mucins. So the team wanted to see if the two could link up, and sure enough, they found that when they combined natural mucin proteins and the synthetic polymers based on muscle adhesives, they got compounds of different strengths, which is great, and they were able to control it. It was like an epoxy, but you know, you combine two liquids together and the chemistry happens and the liquid solidifies, and meanwhile it's gluing itself to the surface, right? So we have this wonderful muscle-based tissue epoxy. Depending on how much mucin you add, you can change the speed at which the liquids gelate and adhere, which can be helpful. In other tests, they took this adhesive and they spread it onto glass panels, and then they incubated it with bacteria overnight to see how well it prevented the buildup of the bugs. They found a bare glass surface without the coating. By the next morning, the bacteria had formed a thick biofilm, whereas with their coating, the biofilms were largely prevented. So they're continuing to play around with different mixtures of mucin and adhesive. But imagine joints and implants, teeth, hips, heart valves. Great. It's great that we have a glue, but a coating of this compound mixed in with the glue could prevent blood-borne bacteria from being able to infect the implants later. And this is one of the problems we have shortly after a person gets an artificial hip or knee or even an implant in their gum their jaw, I should say. There is a period of time where it's quite vulnerable to bacterial infection. So something like this could make it much safer to get an implant, and that's something that we could all be pretty happy with. So more crowdsourcing tonight. Scientists have developed a breakthrough. We've got some good data finally, some data mining of, get this, your own poo, stool, to get better nutrition screening. Now, we've been doing stool DNA testing to look at the microbiome for 15 or 20 years at this point. And that's changed. That's made a fundamental change in the way we approach certain diseases, such as Clostridia difficile and ulcerative colitis. But what if you were to use this to get data on what the person was eating. Now, any regular listener here knows I'm always a little skeptical of food studies because it requires food diaries and questionnaires. When you do studies on humans, you can't just lock them in a motel and feed them for 10 years, and then you know exactly what they had available to eat. This is what we do with lab animals. But with humans, it's much messier than that. They sneak out and get chocolate bars and stuff like that. So, and traditional diaries, they suffer from misreporting, forgetfulness, compliance issues. And so I know most of or much of our nutrition data, particularly those long-term like physicians and nurse wellness studies, it's fuzzy data. I mean, maybe there's trend that you can see, but it really isn't as useful as it could be. So what this metagenomic sample looking at essentially the DNA from the food, looking at genetic information from the foods and accurately detecting food patterns and being able to say by looking at the poop exactly what the person, the child, the adult was eating. They've validated this across two controlled feeding studies, and they are showing good agreement with the data. And they've also, even without food logs, been able to pinpoint dietary features linked to metabolic syndrome in a large clinical cohort. In other words, forget the food diary, just give me some poop, and I'll tell you whether or not your diet is setting you up for disease development. This is going to be transformative for nutrition science. Very excited about it, and very excited about what I'll see coming down the line, so to speak. Okay, we've got an email from Nan in Santa Barbara. Polyphenols. A friend told me about Dr. Dawn praising olive oil and polyphenols. Where can I find that show? Nan, we will research that and send you an email link. I have your email. And just briefly, polyphenols are compounds that are found in plants. Olive oil, of course, being pressed juice from a plant. It's very rich in green polyphenols. These tend to be largely compounds that are anti-inflammatory and antioxidant, which means anti-aging and anti-cancer. And how could you ask for more? I'll also say that olive oil in particular has a strong association with cardiovascular health, and that many of my patients, and I myself, have really switched to using largely olive oil wherever we can. One study, which I cannot tell you where it was published, but I do have a copy of it somewhere in my random files, is giving people a liter bottle of olive oil once a week and telling them to finish it, to go through a liter of olive oil every week. And they measured their cholesterol before and after they did that, and they showed a substantial decrease in bad cholesterol, a rise in good cholesterol. You know, all things went all in the direction while these people were just like, just kicking down the oil. So I'm impressed with that. Polyphenols, greens, particularly leafy greens, that's one of the highest sources. Those colorful vegetables, red, green, yellow, orange, with no red dye number or whatever. Yeah, that's the stuff. And although George Carlin said there's no blue food, I would point out we have purple grapes, we have lovely eggplant, and we have, of course, olives and blueberries. So I would disagree with the king of comedy on the subject of no blue food. There is, however, very little blue junk food. So maybe he was right. It was, after all, stoner humor a couple of decades ago. And last email here, this from Amy from Felton. Dear Dr. Dawn, last week I suddenly noted a lump on the palm of my hand near the base of my rude finger. I'm assuming she means digit number 3. It's a little bit tender and about the size of a pea. So what is it, and should I be worried? It's Amy, you have a classic volar retinacular cyst, most likely. This is a kind of goo-filled bubble that arises from a tendon. And the most common, one of the most common locations for these volar retinacular cysts is at the base of the finger, either the index or the root finger. They are basically like a little ball on a stalk. They can also occur on the back of the hands at the finger joints and the wrist joints in particular, in either side. Very commonly get them. When they're on the wrist, they're often called ganglion cysts or Bible bumps. The treatment for a large Bible bump, and they're kind of ugly looking. So the idea was you would take that big old family Bible, put your hand on a table, and have your loved one smack it. And, of course, the smacking would pop the cyst, and the fluid would harmlessly run out of it. That can be therapeutic, but I don't recommend it for doing that to the hand. The hand is too delicate. And I especially caution you against trying to inject, like trying to drain the cyst the way that you might drain a boil, because you do not want a tendon sheath infection. And so letting that get exposed to the air or cutting into it is a very bad idea. So don't try to get rid of it that way. They can be surgically removed. That takes a hand surgeon for the one where you are. They can affect hand function. And if they are doing that, then of course you should consider maybe seeing a hand specialist. But they generally just sit there and don't cause too much trouble, and they can arise fairly rapidly. I would say don't worry about it. If it's interfering with your activities of daily living, or you are, I don't know, if it's hurting you when you do mountain biking and padded gloves don't do it for you, then you could certainly have it removed. How about DNA origami? Another sort of nature, but this one's geeky, so I'm going to warn you. It's a bit geeky. Most of us probably played with Tinker Toys or Lincoln Logs or Legos in our time. You maybe are still playing with Legos. They seem to have quite the adult following. So you can imagine four different Legos, and the red and green always hook together, and the blue and yellow always hook together. And you have essentially a chain that these Legos can all plug into. Think of your DNA double helix. Well, DNA origami is the subject of the rest of this article. You can churn out a long string of DNA, and that string of DNA will fold as it's churned out into a reproducible shape because of the positive and negative charges on the DNA. And so there's this just crazy, crazy scientist. I mean, crazy in a good way. His name is Paul Rothman, and he's a visiting associate in Caltech in computer and mathematical sciences, computation, and neural systems. But for a hobby, he does DNA origami. In a 2006 paper, he used the technique to create a very, 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 very tiny DNA smiley face, about 100 nanometers across and about two nanometers thick. And so they just keep adding those Legos that are essentially the components of DNA, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. So you've got your adenine always binding your thymine, your guanine always binding to your cytosine, just like those advanced Legos that I was talking about, where only the yellow and the blue could mate. So you give it a shape, you put the whole thing together, and you get a shape. So in this recent work, Rothman and his colleagues used DNA origami to create a larger lily pad structure, about the size of those happy faces from 2006, 100 nanometers in diameter. But attached by a string, there's a gold electrode. Now, this is important because the electrode can sense electricity. So they have little tendrils coming off of this lily pad. And on each of the tendrils, there's a receptor that will bind, you know, essentially like the receptors on the surface of your cells. It'll bind to something you've decided to build it to target. It could be binding to a protein, an antibody, or another molecule of DNA. So they put about 70 tendrils and about 70 different molecules on this lily pad shape. And when it is attached to its target, it drops towards the lily pad. And as it comes into contact with the gold surface, the reporter basically gives up electrons. So these electrons are sensed by the gold electrode, and you have a positive electric current. So it can accommodate and detect large molecules, such as large protein, and this could be a way of testing for just about anything that we currently test for with blood tests. We might be able to do this differently with a sensor like this. So this could be a real shortcut for doing analysis. They've been playing around. These guys are just like playing around. They're like people with a new 3D printer, I swear. So, you know, they added some biotin, and then they turned it into a sensor for the protein streptavidin, which I've never heard of. They added an aptamer that binds to a protein called platelet-derived growth factor, and this is something that is present in cirrhosis and inflammatory bowel disease. So you could have just a drop of blood or maybe a drop of some other body fluid and spit. I'm thinking spit, because a lot of the smaller molecules at least come through in spit. That would be, you know, things go in, things come out. But imagine that a spit test is going to replace that blood test. I mean, I could see the clinic of the future where before you even come through the door, your analysis of all of your chemistries and your CBC and everything has already been very efficiently performed by your home toilet. And the doctor, or maybe it's the AI by then, simply tells you what you've got and what you need to do about it. And, oh, brave new world. Well, I'll be out of a job in no time, but it's sure fun to think about. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.